Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, we're going to hack Apple versus Samsung and your brain. We've got Josh Oriyama, Peter Torin, and Evan Brown to do the hard labor on that. All next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown. Episode 177, recorded August 31st, 2012. That's what clubhouses were for. Hey, folks, it's Denise Howell, and I'm here in the studio for This Week in Law this week. I am telepresently joined by a very esteemed panel. We've got Evan Brown coming in from Chicago. Hello, Evan.
Hey, Denise. How's it going? Happy Friday to you. You're looking where you belong, right there in the studio, looking like it's a lot of fun.
It is fun. You're going to have to come out and do this sometime, Evan. It's really cool be here.
I really want to see all the
decor that you don't generally see in watching the shows on the network. Also joining us, a first-timer on the show, is lawyer and commentator Peter Torin. Hello, Peter.
Hi there. Great to be here. I'm looking forward to this.
Looking forward to having you here with us today. It's wonderful you could join us.
Thank you.
Also joining us today for the first time is Joshua Oriyama. Hello, Josh.
Hi, Denise. Thanks for having me. Really excited to be here.
It's great to have you. Josh writes at LegalGeekery.com and is a friend of lots of friends of the show. So we're happy to have you on today as well. So let's start off with what we couldn't talk about in any sort of detail last week because we were still waiting for the other shoe to drop. It did so shortly after we wrapped TWiL last week, and that is the jury came back in the Apple versus Samsung trial. And we now know what happened in that what seemed to me a very abbreviated romp through all of those various patents that were asserted by both sides. And the jury managed to get through all of that in very short order. But Peter, the outcome can't have been any surprise to you because way back at the beginning of the trial, you wrote a great piece called Why Apple Will Win! ! And it was like you were looking into your crystal ball, wasn't it? Because very many of the things that you predicted wound up coming true. Were you surprised at your accuracy in being able to gauge this case?
Yeah, I was a little surprised at my accuracy. I think what I wrote about and what I believed in, that a jury is going to look at the case as simply, but not necessarily as simplistically as possible. And I think what Apple really had a pretty simple case with regard to the design patents and the trade dress as compared to Samsung's claims for utility patent infringement. And it was a lot easier for the jury simply to compare the products in question and the patents and say, wow, that they look a lot. And Samsung really had their work cut out for them to convince the jury that they didn't copy. And that combined with some of the internal documents that Apple was able to get made it very difficult. And I think the outcome was pretty certain after the first few days of the trial.
So do you think that this is a lesson for the business world to really go forth and get your design patents because it's a little bit easier for a jury to process that than all of the utility patents that were asserted in this case?
I think that it probably will involve a rethinking by a lot of corporations that perhaps they should have focused a little bit more on obtaining design patents and looking at for trade dress protection because, as we all know by now, that Steve Jobs really was very aggressive in seeking intellectual property protection for anything possible and was very adept at using the various intellectual property devices such as design patents, utility patents, trade dress, trademarks to obtain protection for the inventions, for all the Apple innovations, not just in the United States, but throughout the world or wherever you can obtain intellectual property protection, maybe even Mars, for example.
Intellectual property protections on Mars. Now, there's a good topic for us to chew over on Twill. Evan, when we were doing the show last week and the jury was deliberating, did you think that Apple would have such a decisive victory?
Well, I think we could all see the writing on the wall. It comes as no surprise to me. You know, when you look at these devices side by side, to an ordinary observer, you know, they're very, you know, they're very similar. So, you know, at this point, it's kind of hard to recollect exactly how surprised or unsurprised I was a week ago when it came out. But I like the way that Nilay Patel summarized it in, you know, his piece on The Verge that came out on the 24th, was that, you know, just very shortly after the verdict, it says there's no way to interpret this as anything but a sweeping, definitive victory for Apple. So, I mean, the biggest issue, or the biggest point, it's not necessarily an issue in the case, but the biggest point is to remember that this is just the beginning of this. Yeah, there are still motions to be filed and heard, you know, challenging the verdict that Samsung either has filed or will file in this, and certainly will go up to the federal circuit on appeal. So it's by no means the last word on this, but just for a moment, it's worthwhile to pause and consider the different aspects of the fact that Samsung has been awarded Apple has been awarded $1,000,000,000 in this. That's kind of hard to think about, but at the same time, that's this might have been in Peter's or no, I guess it was, you know, something that's after the verdict came out. That's something like 1.5% of Samsung's revenue, which is not, you know, a completely accurate way of thinking about it, because there's the embarrassment, the value of the embarrassment, and then of course, you know, the injunctions against future sales that may be made permanent in all of this. So it's there's a number of different ways of considering what that the number of the damages verdict actually means in all this. And no doubt it's something pretty important.
So now that everyone's taken a deep breath, both sides have recovered from hearing the verdict and are plotting their going forward strategies. Let's talk about that number for a moment, because there was some confusion when the verdict came back. The jury had not actually written in the damages properly, and they had to correct something. We're now in the phase of the proceedings where things begin to get picked apart, and the sides are going to have to choose very carefully what they decide to go after and challenge. We'll see a flurry of post-trial motions, no doubt, and then the ultimate appeal, as you mentioned, Evan. Peter, do you think that the damages aspect of the case is going to be a big target as we go through these post-trial machinations? Do you think that the damages that were awarded were sound?
It's difficult to say. I think that it's been my experience that in most patent cases, damages are one of the areas that could really be attacked, because juries don't necessarily come up with a damage figure in a defensible or a manner that can easily be explained. It's often based on equity, on what they believe would be fair damages. So really the question is, did the evidence that Apple introduced through expert testimony and other testimony, does that really support the jury figure of a little over of $1 billion in damages? Or from that sense, the jury kind of throw darts at the wall and say, well, Apple asked for more than $2 billion. That seems to be a lot of money. And Samsung said they're not entitled to anything. So let's come up with what we think is a fair figure of $1 billion. So it's difficult to say, but it's certainly been my experience that damage awards are often a weak issue that can be attacked at post-trial and at the federal circuit.
Josh, what do you think about the long-term impact of this case as businesses look at, okay, we've come out with what we think is a really innovative and revolutionary product, and then others in the field attempt to compete by offering something that they say is just as good as that kind of product, that maybe resembles the product, as we saw with the phones at issue in this case. Do you think that innovation is well served by what happened here, or ill served?
Well, it's hard to say that it's either well served or ill served. I think that if you really step back and, you know, think about what happened in this trial, as Peter sort of pointed out in his prognostication article, let's call it, since it was so accurate, you know, this is really a framing issue, right? So Apple brings trade dress and design patents into the question, which, you know, stepping aside the fact that, well, in law school, basically, I was taught that, you know, those are the lesser forms of patents. So if you go to the guy on TV who's advertising, like, come get a patent, $100, right? He's probably trying to get you a design patent. So now all of a sudden, we've got this framework for the jury can actually take a step back and look at the two phones next to each other, right? Look at the iPhone, like, look at Samsung's phone before and after the iPhone. And now all of a sudden, we've sort of taken the complex technical issues out of the question. So when you frame it like that, it sort of plays really well into Apple's argument that, hey, we worked for 5 years, spent hundreds of millions of dollars and man hours to make this really perfect and revolutionary iPhone. And then Samsung sort of comes along and in 3 months, with really no risk and relatively no cost, sort of comes in and takes what we did. So really in that respect, I mean, if you believe that framing of the case, you know, it's hard to say that innovation is not well served, because you don't want to have somebody come in after the fact and take in what you've done. But, you know, really the outcome of this case, I think, reflects great framing and really good strategic selection of legal issues.
Peter.
Denise?
Yes, please.
Can I just jump in there? I feel very strongly that the decision was a pro-innovation decision, in that if the defense was, well, we came up with these phones, and though they look alike, it was kind of the only way that smartphones could appear, and we were forced to copy them, that sort of thing. And I think that kind of cheapens intellectual property, because it's the Apple phone. Apple came up with a unique appearance for their phone, and to say that that's the best or only way that a smartphone could appear and the functions could work is I don't think necessarily true. And if Samsung had wanted to and spent the additional time and the resources, who's to say that they wouldn't have come up with a better design, better functions that would have served the consumer better? And I think, so in this case, I think that the outcome of the trial did reflect some of the purposes of intellectual property law.
This brings back to mind an issue we were talking about on last week's show, Denise. It was an article, mm-hmm. and I forget who wrote it now, and I didn't look it up because I didn't know necessarily we'd be talking about it, but it was taken from the position that Apple, there may be a real downside to Apple from winning this case, in as much as it will stimulate Samsung and other participants in the marketplace to innovate more vigorously and to innovate around and perhaps in advance of Apple in all this. So there, it's interesting to see how there is a dark underbelly to you know, strict protection of one's intellectual property through patents, in as much as, you know, the very fact of protecting your innovation will only create a vacuum for yourself, outside of which others have to innovate and do things that perhaps are even better for the consumer and better for the marketplace in general. So it's an interesting corollary to the whole scheme.
It is, and of course, after Apple innovated with the iPhone, the iPad is certainly an equally revolutionary product in its own right. But what I would love some assistance understanding is anybody's thoughts or insights as to how the jury could find so decisively in Apple's favor when it came to phones, but not when it came to tablets. Why is there a distinction there? Peter, do you have some ideas?
I really don't on the evidence. I thought the evidence was pretty strong with regard to the iPad as well. I just think that from a common standpoint, again, it's been my experience, and I've tried a number of patent cases, that a lot of what juries do is to kind of reach an equitable outcome, and they are very much on splitting differences if they can come up with a way to do that. And they may have felt that, okay, we've given Apple, and this is pure speculation on my part, but if we've given Apple a great win when it comes to the iPhones, and the evidence with the iPads isn't quite as strong, and perhaps Samsung had some good defenses. So they said, well, we're not going to award, you know, that Apple doesn't deserve a grand slam in this, and we're only going to give them a two-run homer, to use a weak baseball analogy.
Josh, do you see any reason why, you know, I mean, the iPad is basically an iPhone on steroids. It uses the same OS, the same App Store, the same icons. What happened here?
Yeah, I have to agree with Peter. I mean, it's impossible to say what happened. I don't know that I would have come to the same decision in the jury situation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think in the end, juries tend to be fairly equitable in how they decide things. And so this maybe is just a case of, well, it was clear that the iPhone was, it may be a case that the other phones were infringing upon the iPhone. But, you know, we think that that's sufficient. I just don't even have a guess as to how they would have come to that conclusion.
Okay. Evan, we're now seeing that Apple has moved forward to enjoin the sale of certain of its products in the U.S. Is that going to be the only fallout here, you know, as a practical matter, aside from all the legal machinations that will ensue now as both sides try and determine whether they like what the jury has done and want to let it stand? What else do you see happening?
I think that to the extent that Apple is successful in getting Samsung products out of the marketplace because of this particular success, is going to be a very limited effect. I mean, already, you know, the Galaxy S is fading out, and, you know, the Galaxy S3 was not even at issue here, and that's the hottest selling Samsung phone right now, at least I've been told or I've read that. So this is, you know, with things happening in such a increasingly rapid pace, you know, this is going to fade into memory pretty soon. It's a big deal, $1 billion verdict. It's a big news and all that stuff. But, I think it's, given the pace of innovation, given our continually shortening attention spans as consumers, as commentators, as observers, the effect is going to be quickly dissipated, and the marketplace will regulate pretty soon with lots of new innovative products, both from Apple and from, as I was, you know, saying just a few moments ago, from other participants in the same market space. So it's continually an exciting time for consumer electronics like this.
Well, what you said a few minutes ago led me to think that perhaps what we'll see is litigation coming the other way, because Samsung and other handset makers have been first to market with something that is between a tablet and a phone, sort of the scaled down tablet or the scaled up phone, which people speculate that Apple may be going in the same direction, but we haven't seen that yet. So are we going to see this case in reverse?
That's a good point. I hadn't really thought of it that way, you know, but it makes some sense, especially, you know, I mean, if with the way that the iPhone 5 looks a little bit like a bigger phone, you know.
Now, how do you know what the iPhone 5 looks like?
I found a prototype at a bar. You know? we haven't seen that routine and all that stuff. But right. You've seen the same stuff that I've seen when it comes to that. So yeah, I don't know. To be honest, I hadn't really thought that through. But that's a great point. One that we should consider.
Right, and Samsung tried, you know, coming back after Apple, but didn't have much success. Peter, how about the patents, the utility patents that Samsung was asserting, particularly with connecting to a network? You would think that they would have made more headway there, but perhaps, as you were saying earlier, the jury was just beyond that and trying to reach an equitable outcome. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that it was very difficult for Samsung to focus on, or have the jury, I should say, focus on the utility patents when the main focus really of the trial was about the design. And I mean, utility patents, and these utility patents could be difficult for patent attorneys to understand, let alone, I know there were some engineers on the jury, but lay people certainly have a great deal of understanding some very complex technology that was involved here. And I think that it was a very difficult situation for Samsung to have the jury focus on a very difficult technology when it was much easier to have them focus on the appearance of the Samsung phones and the iPhone. And I'll offer one other prognostication now on what I think is going to happen. I'll go out on the limb one more time. Maybe I won't be so correct again, but I think that the case is liable to settle before the Federal Circuit hears oral arguments. I think that Apple has gotten everything they can out of the case through the publicity, through the likely injunction of the 8 devices. And I think that, you know, they would accept a lesser settlement. I have no idea what they would be willing to accept with a permanent injunction and move on for a lesser amount without having to worry about whether the Federal Circuit is going to do on appeal. So I think there's a high likelihood that the case will settle before the Federal Circuit hears it sometime down the road.
Would the big leverage that Samsung would use to negotiate a settlement be just the uncertainty on appeal, or would it be the permanent injunction question, or what do you think Samsung's strategy would be in trying to work something out like that?
I think the leverage would be the certainty that, for example, let's say Samsung would say to Apple, we're willing to pay you, you know, $400 million, $500 million dollars. Well, the products that you want the injunction for are old products. We're willing to take them off the market in the United States, pay you $400 million, and that removes any uncertainty about having the Federal Circuit reverse and having to go through this whole thing again with products that are really outdated at this particular time. So the question is Apple willing to settle for 40 cents, 50 cents on a dollar, 25 cents on a dollar for a certain outcome? And I think there could be strong arguments made that Apple's gotten everything out of it. They don't need the money. They've got, what, $115 billion or more in cash. What's another $400, $500 million going to do? And with the certainty of the decision, I think there's a lot to be said for that.
And of course, you have to fold in the fact that there are multiple suits between these parties going on worldwide. Sure. And that mixed outcomes have already happened and might continue to do so. So getting some certainty might be something that Samsung can use as a bargaining chip. Josh, suppose you're one of the people who owns one of the phones that's going to be enjoined. Do you think that there will be any negative impact on them? I mean, obviously, these things will no longer be for sale, but a lot of them are out there in the marketplace. Do you think that they'll just be cut off from a customer service standpoint? What's the practical outcome there?
Yeah, that's a good question that I've never really thought about. I mean, I imagine that, you know, the secondhand market could be either helped or hurt based on, well, there won't be many of them left. You won't be able to buy any new ones. Mm-hmm. But as far as just the everyday person who owns the phone, I mean, you know, they've got their own app store. I don't think there'll really be any effect there. I don't think there's really any way you can force people not to use the phone that they've already bought just because of for sale issues and that sort of thing. But, you know, practically to the person who just owns the phone, I don't really know that there will be any ramifications.
Peter, let's talk about the appellate issues here. Assuming that your prognostication is not correct, if you were the Samsung attorneys considering appeal, how would you go after the verdict?
From what I can tell, and is probably true with many cases, the way to go after the verdict may be through the jury instructions. Mm-hmm. The jury instructions in this particular case were fought over. Every word was debated. They were 103 pages long. So if there are any misstatements in the jury instructions, if Samsung didn't get what they want, if it led to an incorrect decision, that may be a way to really attack the verdict. Because it's, you know, you've got 103 pages of jury instructions, there's certainly a lot of room for errors and other mistakes that may have been made.
Evan, you're a litigator. Jury instructions and lengthy special verdict forms are sort of a mixed bag that way, aren't they? The more complicated you make things, the more holes you can poke in them on appeal.
Right, and that's just kind of a natural risk, you know, that it's inherent in this type of litigation in particular because of the complexity. And, you know, notwithstanding the fact that the design patent issues were, you know, by design on Apple's part there to simplify it for the jury's mind. I share in Peter's observation, you know, as to how that played into Apple's strategy in all of this. You know, there's no way... also, notwithstanding something I think we may mention later in the show, like the International Plain Language Day, there's no way to effectively communicate in very simple, concise language these types of issues to the jury for them to consider. You know, even in non-patent cases, it's hard to be precise when you're talking to a jury and ask them to make particular findings and to draw certain conclusions. And so, it definitely would be an area that's ripe for Samsung to try to poke holes in and find weaknesses and error that would warrant this to go back to the district court level for further determinations or something along those lines. You know, back to an issue we were just talking about a moment ago. I have here a Galaxy S. You know, just the plain old 4G Galaxy S. So I'll let you know what it's like. You know, so far it's amazing how quickly one comes to feel anachronistic, or you know, that one's devices become antiquated. I got this in April of 2011, and you know, I thought it was just the best thing since sliced bread. And
we're just an outlaw now.
That's right.
Toting a banned device.
I feel so renegade. I hope nobody has a tight geolocation on where I am precisely right now. Actually, everybody would know where I am right now, or I'm going to be led away by the feds or something. So I'll let you know how my experience goes. I have a feeling it'll be just fine.
Right.
Well, I guess you didn't know that one of Steve Jobs' final acts before he died was to set up the Apple police.
Oh, great. Great. I'm glad I'm in the Midwest.
So, of course... the jury's actions are subject to review on appeal, and so are the judges with respect to evidence that was let in or kept out, the various judgment calls that the judge makes. If they can be cast as something that could have skewed the outcome of the case, they can be the basis of setting something aside on appeal. One of the things that got a lot of attention in the media was evidence of quote-unquote prior art that didn't come in. Josh, do you think that will be something we hear about on appeal or no? Because, the one bit of evidence that I recall hearing about, the 2001 evidence, you know, tablets existed a long time ago. I don't know if a court of appeal is going to think that things in sci-fi should have any role in the case or not. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I can say that, you know, as a former appellate attorney, you often have the issues that maybe you think are good ideas, like the jury instruction potentially is a strong issue. And then you have issues that maybe aren't so strong, such as, you know, what you're talking about here. But in the end, it's a cost-benefit analysis. Should I put that issue in my brief and sort of potentially have credibility issues because I know it's not such a strong topic. But I mean, when you have an issue like that a judge actually rules against letting you bring something in, I mean, often when you're sitting in front of, you know, an appellate panel, it becomes a question. Well, you can be grilled on it, let's say, just because, you know, it's really an abuse of discretion oftentimes when you're talking about something like that. So then you're arguing facts and policy, and really that doesn't play well to appellate judges. So I think you put it in. I think you put it in knowing that it probably is not going to win, but I think you put it in anyway.
I think you argue what we were talking about before, too, that, you know, it just doesn't make cognitive sense to come down so far in Apple's favor on the phone issues, but not on the iPad issues, and that maybe there's some flaw in the reasoning on the phone issues, and it should be they should go the way of the iPad issues. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not the lawyer here for Samsung, but I would certainly be thinking along those lines or working through how to cast that argument to the Court of Appeal. Let's go around and see if you guys have any final thoughts, since this has been such a big decision and so many people have so many questions and are wondering so much about it. Peter, give us your final summation, if you will, about Apple versus Samsung.
Well, I think, you know, my final summation is really what I think is going to happen, that I think it's likely that the case will settle before the appeals court hears it. And failing that, I think because it was a jury verdict, and I'm not aware, it's hard to know exactly what mistakes may have been made and what, you know, where the areas are open for appeal. But I think it's likely that the Federal Circuit would affirm the judgment if in fact they did hear the case.
Josh?
I guess my observation isn't so much a legal observation, but, you know, I am a big listener of Tech News Today and various other tech and legal podcasts, and I am just, for one, very happy to see this case for now finished anyway.
You've been inundated, huh?
Pretty much. But, you know, I think that the ultimate decision was the right one. I think overall it is a win for innovation. And yeah, like I said, I'm happy that it's over now.
Evan?
I guess I just want to say 1,000,000,000 again. That's kind of cool. I guess the decision was right based on the evidence. I didn't look at all the evidence, but based on, you know, what I understand about it, it looks right. But, you know, having purchased, as I pointed out already, an infringing device, I certainly was not confused when I bought it, and I didn't buy it because I thought it was an iPhone or I thought that it, you know, incorporated the technology in an iPhone. So from a personal level, it's just like, I don't really care, I guess. But, you know, in the end, it'll all, even out, and the effects will be distributed into the marketplace and the overall ecosystem.
And I guess my own final takeaway is, if I'm at a company assessing my patent portfolio, I'm certainly going to put a lot more weight on design patents that seem to have a lot more accessibility to juries in enforcement, if this case is any indication, and to trade dress kind of strategies, because as we've been talking through here today, it seems like the side-by-side comparison really carried the day here, and that Apple's emphasis on design in its products and in getting those design patents wound up being a good strategy. So I guess maybe the weighted value of the patent portfolio might be something that we see going forward. All right, let's move on and talk a bit about privacy. Evan, aside from what, you know, we share on the show and aside from what I confide in my family, I generally think that the contents of my brain are protected from what others might be able to suss out. But scientifically, that may be becoming less and less the case. You want to bring us up to speed on that?
Sure. There was an article on TechCrunch this past week that summarized the findings of an academic paper that some scientists across the country and you know, from a couple different universities here in the U.S. and I think scientists from Oxford was involved with as well, where using commercially available hardware that's used for gaming, for example, they've been able to evaluate the magnetic activity in one's brain and extract information. Essentially be able to get closer to reading what the subject's thoughts are. Now, it's not like they're just pulling information and pulling a data file from the brain so that they know what's going on here. But for example, if a person is shown a photo of a familiar face, there's a certain signature to that brain activity, or a PIN number. There are, about 40% accuracy rate of figuring out what the first number in a series of integers was, for a PIN number. So what we have here is an example of technology that is shining the light on ways in which others can be more evasive in figuring out what is in another person's mind, what information is there. And so the privacy implications are pretty obvious when it comes to that. And so there's a lot of different ways we could take this discussion. At the outline level, I see big issues in the criminal investigation type of context that would give rise to issues under the 4th, 5th, and 6th amendments of our Constitution here in the United States. And, you know, each one of those amendments carries with them a lot of weight when it comes to our civil liberties. So, the future could be a pretty creepy place if we don't manage the different issues that arise from the opportunities that technology affords us to get into other people's brains. It could be really, really interesting to see how this goes in the future.
So as we creep toward the singularity, it seems like there may be opportunities before we have uploaded our consciousness and everything is machine readable to get inside our brains anyway. Josh, you're a friend of Ryan Kallos, who we've had on the show and who loves to think about these issues and robotics and the singularity and all. What are your thoughts here?
Yeah, so it's interesting to think about, especially from a Fourth Amendment context, I think, because what I always found disconcerting about Fourth Amendment really goes all the way back to Crim Pro in law school, which is, you know, Justice Harlan's concurrence in Katz, which talks about reasonable expectation of privacy. So, right, so there's this focus, and it's really an objective test, on whether actions are objectively reasonable in the eyes of society, right? So really, all you need to do to make something, you know, fit that description is desensitize them to an issue, right? So as the government, you know, uses thermal goggles to find marijuana growers, or, you know, has this little hat that you can put on somebody to sort of read their thoughts, then at some point, you know, you're just so exposed to this idea that it potentially could become objectively reasonable. And, I think that potentially, it wouldn't be totally surprising to me if at some point somebody found that this wasn't a breach of privacy. But yeah, it concerns me that that's the case.
Peter, how do you think we should deal with this from a legislative and regulatory standpoint? Do we need to be considering how to regulate and control authorized versus unauthorized access to one's reactions, which can betray one's thoughts?
This is a very difficult area. And what I'm really most concerned about is this kind of generational creep that both was mentioned different terms earlier, that what may be a reasonable expectation of privacy today is, you know, creeping forward, that it may no longer be reasonable for the future to read, or unreasonable to read people's minds. And I think I kind of blame the changes in what is a reasonable expectation of privacy, and I would regard as a lessening standards, more on social media, for example, than on the government, because what people put up, their private details, things like that, I would never think of doing, and people younger than me put that kind of stuff, and there's a real change of what a reasonable expectation of privacy is today. So I think the answer to your question really is that to avoid this creep of what is a reasonable expectation of privacy, not so much legislative, but the courts have to be looking at not necessarily the original intent of the framers, but really what is a objective, reasonable expectation of privacy, what it was like 30, 50 years ago, what it's like today, and what it may be like tomorrow, and not necessarily change the standard with the technology. The same sort of standard has to be applied regardless of what the technology involved is.
So we'll go ahead and make brain hacking our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. Evan, walk us through what might happen here in an interrogation, Fifth Amendment, Miranda kind of context.
Yeah, well, this would all happen after the, I guess there could still be a Fourth Amendment issue here, you know, whether or not you are searching the contents of the person's brain and the Fourth Amendment, the text talks about security, among other things, in our persons, you know, so we really are front and center on what the Fourth Amendment looks to protect here. But going into the context of an interrogation, you know, the most people know at least indirectly about the Fifth and the Sixth Amendment protections, or some of the protections that the Fifth and Sixth Amendments provide to us through, you know, watching police shows on television where they read the suspect the Miranda rights. And reading the Miranda rights do are really twofold. It lets the defendant know that he has a right not to incriminate himself, and also the Sixth Amendment right to have a lawyer present if there's any interrogation going on. So in the Fifth Amendment context, the issues are pretty interesting here with this technology of being able to see what's going on electromagnetically in someone's brain, because the question becomes, at what point is that a testimonial act, an act of saying something about what's going on in one's mind that would rise to the level of being protected by the Fifth Amendment? The privilege of not incriminating ourselves is the radiation, the transmission of information going on in your brain, even if it's not voluntary, something that would trigger the Fifth Amendment type of protection. The other interesting issue, or the interesting issue under the Sixth Amendment, would be similar to this. Is that really an interrogation going on? Say that the defendant had been read his or her Miranda. I'll just say his because most criminals seem to be men, right? His Miranda rights in all this stuff, and they continued to do to use this technology before the lawyer showed up to be present during questioning. Would that somehow run afoul of that Sixth Amendment right that arises to have the lawyer present there? What it really does in both of, really in all of these scenarios, is it blurs the line not only blurs the line between people as to what is truly one's thoughts and what is, in a metaphorical sense, the property of one's mind. It blurs the line between people, and the technology blurs the line between interrogation and it muddies the water of what particularly interrogation is, if it means asking a question or whether it means, allowing one to know what is in one's mind. We already see some other examples where technology has blurred these lines. You know, does providing the password for your encrypted hard drive, is that a testimonial act that should be protected by the Fifth Amendment? So we're just afforded yet another opportunity here to consider how these issues become more complex and figure out some way that will avoid us from going down a path into a really dark future where our expectations of privacy have diminished essentially to nothing. Let's hope that if it indeed is true that our expectations of privacy are slowly, we're allowing them to slowly erode away over time through the use of social media and other collaborative technologies and other stuff like that, that the pendulum may swing back in the sensibilities of all people, especially when confronted with ultra-invasive means of knowing the contents of one's mind, like we have an exemplar of right here.
Yeah, I mean, ideally, law enforcement isn't so much about wanting to interrogate people who are suspects or witnesses. It's about wanting to get at the truth. And if they can find more efficient ways of discerning what actually happened than having questions answered and asked, then I'm sure they're going to try and go down that road. The chat room's saying that we all have tinfoil hats on and are, perhaps being a bit alarmist about all this. Josh, do you have any final thoughts before we move on?
Yeah, I was really glad that Evan brought up the password issue, because it was really the first thing that came into my mind. And I disagree with the chat room. I think that our Fifth Amendment rights are definitely on the decline, and I think it's it'll be a problem going forward. And so once I found out that a court can force me to hand over my password to an encrypted file, I sort of had a feeling that, you know, this could be an issue in the future. And so the problem with that is that I can always tell a court, hey, I don't remember the password. You know, it was really long. I wrote it down somewhere. I destroyed it. Well, all of a sudden, here's a convenient way that somebody with some tweaking to the technology can basically extract that password from my mind in a fair, arguably minimally intrusive way. So, I mean, maybe we're wearing tinfoil hats, maybe we're not. But, you know, at some point, this is going to become an issue. So we might as well talk about it now.
Yeah, it just seems like such a huge leap from where we are now, where lie detector tests are not admissible in court because of their inherent unreliability. And you guys can correct me on that if I have that wrong. I don't know if they have, you know, gained more credibility than I remember from criminal procedure in law school, which was quite some time ago at this juncture. But to go from that to, okay, you know, we have a way of determining the contents of your brain from your reactions to certain stimuli, seems to me a pretty large leap, but, you know, one that is down the road at some point, just maybe not here yet.
There's plenty to be concerned about, even if the evidence itself were not admissible, because as we've discussed fairly recently on the show, in the example of that case where the guy's Facebook friend allowed the government to look through his account at the defendant's profile to get information about a crime, you know, the issue is not necessarily whether or not the evidence is going to be ultimately admissible at trial, but the more important and more pressing issue, and the issue that threatens our civil liberties more, is what kind of investigation can be done merely to give rise to probable cause, which then supports a warrant that the government can go swear out, and then we're off to the races and the horse has left the barn, because nobody's going to be able to challenge the admissibility of evidence that was gotten pursuant to a warrant that was, you know, supported by probable cause. So it's easy for things to get way out of control that need to be pulled in now, and we need to be careful about these things. And Iaz pointed out in the chat room that he wears an aluminum foil hat. That's what I do as well. I haven't seen tinfoil in the market for a long place. So if you're wearing a tinfoil hat, you guys are unprotected. So don't be unprotected. Wear aluminum foil.
All right. I just don't know what to do with that. We've been dancing around the fact that social media makes the contents of our mind more transparent as well. So let's move on over to some social web law. One thing that we've been monitoring is the Facebook-sponsored Stories settlement. There's a class action pending against Facebook where the parties had reached a settlement that would have involved $20 million being paid by Facebook, $10 million to charity, and $10 million to the plaintiff's attorneys in the case. The judge in that case has set that aside, doesn't like that settlement at all, thinks that actually, under the law in California, because when you use someone's likeness without their permission, you can have up to $750 of damages per instance. And there are 70 million plaintiffs or users involved in this lawsuit, that the damages were way out of whack with what they could have been. And also that it's only resulting in pennies to the actual plaintiffs in the case, as opposed to their lawyers. So the judge is tossing this out, and we'll have to see if the parties come back with some other proposed settlement or decide to move forward. Evan, are you surprised that the judge has intervened here?
Well, it's, you know, it's not like they have to totally go back to the drawing board on all this. What this was a motion for a preliminary approval of a settlement agreement, which is a kind of a stage in the class action litigation that goes on, where you go to the court and say, Judge, is this going to look all right? What do you think of this? Can you check this out for us before we start really getting the class members involved and notifying them and all that stuff, to kind of just a preliminary check on all this stuff? So I'm glad the judge did this. It shows that there's some thoroughness going on. I mean, if there's $20 million at stake, at least on its face, you know, that kind of as an issue whether or not those numbers are actually correct. But if at least ostensibly that's what's at stake here, plus the certain remedial measures that Facebook, actually they'd be more prospective in order to remedy the situation, you know, what Facebook's going to do to protect people's privacy in the future. It's an important societal interest as well. I'm glad the judge took a serious look at this. I'm pretty skeptical about the effectiveness and the real societal benefit of class action litigation from the outset. So, you know, from a personal or personal philosophical point of view approach, I'm glad to see that the judge is paying attention to the details here. And it's interesting to see why the judge is concerned about things and not letting the parties just rubber stamp things and kind of gloss over details, and also putting the lawyers to the task, the plaintiff's lawyers to their task of why $10 million smooth sailing provision is what they're referring to this is, like Facebook has agreed not to object to any request that the plaintiff's lawyers would make for up to $10 million. That is a lot of money to pay plaintiff's lawyers in a lawsuit like this that was just filed.
Right. There hasn't been discovery. There hasn't been much discovery. Yeah. There hasn't been a trial.
Right. So it's a really big number. And, of course, lawyers are incredibly important, and they should be paid a lot, right? that's a lot of cash.
Yeah, let me just jump in there. And I really applaud Judge Seaborg's position here and Judge Rakoff's position in some not approving some security class action and security litigation settlements, because I don't think that they're really, in particular, this settlement accomplishes anything except provide $10 million to the plaintiff's firm. It doesn't really change Facebook's actions at all. $10 million, if another standard for damages is $750 per act, $10 million is really nothing. So I think I really applaud what Judge Seaborg did in this particular case.
Yeah, and I think that the judge is even being, you know, somewhat conservative in his estimate of what the damages could be in a misappropriation of name and likeness under the California law. Josh, what do you think of this?
Yeah, I mean, I won't claim to be an expert in damages or class actions or anything like that. But, you know, it does seem that there is a possibility of obtaining a whole lot more money and then getting everybody involved a whole lot more money. So it's nice to have a judge who actually steps in and looks at it and says, well, you know, counsel is getting an inordinate amount of money, and so I'm going to do something about this. You know, I think it's good that judges are willing to step in and do that sort of thing and basically look out for all the members. So I think it's good.
All right. Well, if Facebook has to make everybody opt in to make their sponsored stories strategy work, it seems to me like they're really getting shot in the foot, given that people may not be exactly who they hold themselves out as on Facebook. Evan, you had a pretty interesting story that you linked to on how vanity and people's projected images rather than their actual selves may be sabotaging Facebook's advertising strategies.
Yeah, this was a really interesting piece by Louis Herr over on Digital Trends. It was published on August 19th, and it was called "That's Not the Real Me: How Vanity Sabotages Facebook Advertising." And I would really recommend somebody to anybody to read this over the weekend if you haven't looked at it yet, because this is something that I feel like I recognized in myself when I was on Facebook, and I've heard other people talk about this phenomenon, and I guess it's been talked about in psychology circles for the better part of a half century. There was the famous Canadian sociologist Irving Goffman, who talked about how we it seemed kind of Jungian, and you know, I'm getting out of my field. I'm not a psychology expert or anything like this, but it's how we put a public persona on ourselves, and we develop this image of ourselves that we project to the world, which may be not congruent at all to who we truly are in our inauthentic selves. May be incongruent with our authentic self. So, it's interesting to see how that plays out in the context of social media, where, for example, with Facebook, we are given the tools through this platform to construct a very granular, high resolution picture of ourselves. And most of us, when we use these tools, put our best foot forward. I remember on the show in the past, we've talked about an article where somebody was commenting on a similar point here. You know, you put the pictures of your family all happy at the beach. You know, if you're with your kids, you know, you're there at the beach, you don't post pictures of, you know, your 3-year-old who's up at 2:30 in the morning vomiting. You know, that's not the part that you put to the world.
Well, some people do. And, or maybe YouTube's more the forum for that.
There you go. More power to them, you know. So I think most of us feel this way. We want to project ourselves in a certain way that's positive, so that the esteem in the community is raised by this stuff. So how that plays into to Facebook and its revenue model and advertising, you know, the accuracy and the efficiency of advertising is based on getting a good high resolution picture of who someone is, what their preferences are, what they do, who they know, who they interact with, what they are doing on the weekend and all that stuff. And so if we're painting this false picture, just as much as there is incongruency between who we are portraying ourselves to be and who we truly are, there is going to be a mismatch in the strength and the effectiveness of targeting this advertising. So that's interesting from a business perspective. I take it a little bit, one step further than what the article does in my thinking on this, and ask the question, should this affect or influence our sensibilities when it comes to privacy on social networks? If we're going to start from the premise that who we are on social media is not who we truly are, what is the benefit to us, or what's the big deal in protecting that information if it's fake to begin with? So that's something that I like thinking about, is should this inform our discussions and our thoughts when it comes to privacy and how we're going to regulate it and otherwise manage the issue as we go into the future and more of this stuff is going to be open like this.
Peter, this sort of goes to what you were saying before about how we portray ourselves on social media and what sort of information we put there. Do you agree with Evan that there are privacy ramifications to the fact that people selectively create a persona?
I think that's definitely true. I think where it comes into play is some people create what can be regarded as a false persona. So how do you deal with people like that versus other people may really put a much more of a true persona on Facebook or on social media? So do you give more protection to one versus the other? But it kind of dilutes the pool where you may have false personas and true personas being put on social media.
Social media has just complicated everything. Josh, you're probably too young to really remember this, but years and years ago when blogging first came around, that was our only social media. You know, you put it all in one place and it all hung out in the same kind of way. You know, if you wanted to put your pictures of your kid on the beach, you had one forum to do it. And then if you wanted to dissect the latest decision from the United States Supreme Court, if you were a lawyer, you did it in the same place. And so, you know, you had this sort of multi-faceted picture of yourself all in one venue. And I guess it just doesn't happen that way anymore. We've all been sort of parsed up and divided. Mm-hmm. Evan, do you think that there is a legal overlay to that reality?
I was just going to make fun of you for sounding all nostalgic about the early days of blogging. It's like, oh, back in 2004, we didn't have to worry about this stuff.
You know? It's so true.
I guess there is. I mean, it's interesting now that, I mean, because one phenomenon I think we're identifying here is that who we are online now is actually disintegrated in a certain extent. Last decade, we were talking about disintermediation, between publisher and consumer of content, you know, Coltrane Manifesto and all that stuff. Now it's as if there is, I don't know if it's a related concept or if it's just that the words kind of sound the same with disintermediation and disintegration, but, you know, now our online presences are, you know, out there and fragmented. And so, it seems to me that the legal context comes in the ability in protecting against the aggregation of that information in a certain way. And, you know, it's something I would need to think through a little bit further, I guess.
Evan, can I ask you, I'd like to pose a question and see what you think about this, right? So I'm wondering really, does this actually matter? Because I'm coming at this from this perspective that, we're not talking about somebody being deceitful in, you know, what they're doing. We're talking about somebody putting their best foot forward, which, you know, I'll give you an example about why I think maybe this doesn't matter as much as the author does, right? So I'm from Boston. Most of my friends from back home are Red Sox fans, right? Maybe they post an inordinate amount about the Red Sox on their Facebook page, and as a result, they get more ads for that. So maybe they're not as hardcore fans of the Red Sox as you might think they are, and so of course they're getting all these ads, but at the same time, they are a Red Sox fan. You know, that's why they're saying it. And they're potentially likely to buy apparel or, you know, something of that sort because they sort of want to put forth that facade. So really, is this an issue that hurts anybody if we're not makes advertising irrelevant with respect to those issues? Or, what do you think about that?
Well, yeah, I think that really frames the issue pretty well because, you know, where is the harm in all of this? And I think that's the gist of the article that we're discussing here by Louis Herr, you know, that it affects the advertising and the strength of that. And so the harm would translate into economic harm, both in the worldview of the advertisers themselves who are footing the bill for this. And I guess by extension, it would do nothing to help Facebook's stock value, which could use all the help that it can right now as well. So, I mean, it translates into a missing the mark when it comes to the expectations of how social media can be monetized. I guess it's kind of a separate category. I'm sure they're not mutually exclusive. We can find some overlap and concern, but, you know, with the question of privacy and the privacy of the user, I would say it matters not at all. If somebody's persona through social media is inaccurate. I mean, to the extent it is inaccurate, to the extent that Facebook thinks that they are a Red Sox fan, but in reality they're not, there's little interest there to be protected at all. And so the law and norms shouldn't step in to interfere with that if there's no real personal or dignitary interest to be protected in the first place.
Somebody might consider it defamatory.
Right. And I mean, if I were to say something about, you know, being a Cubs fan, I think I'm pretty much defamatory proof. You know, you can't say anything about that couldn't be more harmful than just saying you're a Cubs fan. But that's obviously a very separate issue.
Well, it's back to brain hacking, right? If law enforcement has one way of going at it, Facebook tries to go about it another way. But my take on it is they're less able to do it. They, you know, their tools are much more speculative and entirely based on breadcrumbs that people leave behind. So I don't know what we make of that from a Fourth Amendment or Fifth Amendment standpoint, but the courts will continue to struggle with it. Another thing that the courts have been struggling with is the use of technology and networked communications by increasingly younger and younger people, including minors, particularly an 11-year-old boy in this instance. This is the youngest instance I can think of, Evan, where someone's actually been arrested for sexting. What's your take on this?
Yeah, this happened in my hometown, Bedford, mm-hmm. Indiana. So I ran across this piece, you know, reading the local news, not, mm-hmm. you know, like looking at Wired or Ars Technica. So the kid sent a naked picture of himself to a girl, I guess, in his class or something like that. The girl's parents found it and called the cops, and the kid got arrested. And that's all we know. And that's mm-hmm. probably all we really ever know, because, you know, so there's so much privacy protection in the juvenile justice system and all that stuff. So the first question that comes to my mind when we hear about minors and sexting and minors who are arrested for sexting for something that is you know, pretty toxic. He was arrested for distributing content that's harmful to a minor. There's always an immediate irony in that, because it's a minor distributing content that's harmful to a minor. There's obviously some dissonance that we need to sort out here. And the way that we start sorting out that dissonance is asking ourselves, is the criminal justice system the proper way to sort out these problems? Clearly, this is an ill that as a society we are facing. There are high resolution cameras and 4G connections in the hands of young children who are naturally inquisitive and get more inquisitive as they approach puberty and go on. And, you know, and then it only goes all to hell after, you know, you get to be an adult when it gets all this stuff. So, you know, there seems to be some real problem here with making criminals out of kids doing this. And so, I mean, I would introduce that as a question to discuss, but I think it's also worthwhile to discuss the position of the girl who got the photo and, you know, what her parents might be thinking in all of this stuff. But, you know, we can kind of address those issues. I think the real big issue is what to do with the kid who I guess technically broke the law here. Should he be made a criminal? And I think that's a hard question to answer.
I think it's an easy question to answer, and the answer is no. You know, there's absolutely no reason why an 11-year-old, you know, I'll show you yours if you show me mine kind of exchange should trigger criminal law just because the parents have given their child a device that makes that possible. You know, if they're standing in the same room, this kind of thing happens. Evan, you have young kids. Maybe they're not old enough to be this inquisitive and right. exploratory with each other yet, but it happens. And it happens whether their friends are females or males. It's just kind of a thing that's part of growing up. And so, yeah. You know, the law has to recognize that at some point there's no criminal implication from doing something like this. I don't know, Peter, am I wrong about this?
You know, I, Denise, I agree with you completely. I think if this situation had happened and they were, as you said, the same room, and the girl's parents had found out about it, I think the reaction or the proper response would have been gone to the boy's parent and say, look, do you know what happened? We don't approve of this. We can't let it go on. And if it happens again, we're going to take, there may be serious consequences. But to make a criminal out of an 11-year-old who really probably doesn't know better, doesn't understand things, I really think is a large mistake on the part of the criminal justice system.
Right. And until we manage to fix that, it's not going to get any better, is it, Josh? I mean, I look around at the kids that, you know, surround my family and my child, and, you know, mine's in the minority in that he does not have a phone at 8 years old. He has other devices that can, you know, serve that purpose if he's connected to Wi-Fi, but he doesn't yet have a phone. Most of them do.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we really have to come to the point where we recognize that the law has really been overreaching, I think, with respect to this issue. And so I think really it's time for the legislature to come forward and say, you know, we wrote these laws not because we want to protect children from each other. We wrote them because we really want to prevent predatory behavior. So, you know, if we could get the laws to reflect that, the spirit of, I think, what was intended by, you know, our state congresses and our state legislature, then I think we'd be in a much better position than we are now.
Right. In IRC, we're learning that clubhouses used to serve this purpose as opposed to people's technological devices. But Yeah. It's the world we live in.
Well, let me say a couple of things more about this. I mean, first of all, I just want to make it very clear that I agree with all three of you that turning this kid into a criminal is wrong. It should not be a crime what he did. It should be sorted out in some other way. And it would be a tragedy on top of a tragedy if he were, you know, put on some kind of sex offender list.
God, yes. And,
you know, to be branded with that moniker for any period of time. So, but, you know, one point, and I alluded to this when I introduced the issue, one point I think might be overlooked here is the sensibilities of the girl's parents who, you know, the girl who got this. You know, if, well, you know, Peter, you made the analogy or the comparison of the situation if this had been in the same room and it not been, you know, distributed in this way. They would have dealt with it by going to his parents and sorting it out that way. The law here, I think, is doing everybody a disservice, perhaps, and I can't get into the mind of the parents. But for one thing, I know that they're probably pretty ticked off that this happened. So they want something to be done. You know, that this boy is sending photos of himself to their daughter. Any parent of an 11-year-old girl was going to be pretty ticked off about that. So they're not going to be so quick to just say, oh, you know, let's just sort it out. Let's all get together and, you know, and work it out some other way. They want some kind of punitive measure to be done. So maybe they're not as angry as what I think they would be. I have a feeling that there's another aspect motivating the parents in all this, a little bit of a freak out on their part, the fact that within the confines of their home is this illegal content, a photo of a naked 11-year-old boy. I mean, talk about something toxic. So I wonder how much they felt like they had no choice but to go to the police. Because otherwise, you know, what's going to happen to this family if it is discovered that there is a digital, you know, a JPEG image of an 11-year-old boy's penis, you know, within the confines of their home?
Right.
That's
right.
A pretty there. It's like damned if you do, damned if you don't. I realize I'm dropping some obscenities into this for some, you know, I'm sorry.
But, our clean tagged show here.
Right. Sorry. But they're between Scylla and Charybdis. In this, you know, they have to do something. And that's where the law maybe be doing a disservice, but kind of in another way, coming from a different angle on all of this stuff.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's the same kind of concern you have as a parent where you have a kid over and everybody's changing and nuding up and they're, you know, you're wondering, okay, I hope everyone else's parents are all right with all this. And gee, I don't know how comfortable I am having another child disrobed in my home because of what they might think. But we did get some practical advice from Popeye Arms in IRC, which I think is such a good tip, bit of parental wisdom that I'm going to toss it out there for you all, that Popeye Arms says a kid shouldn't have a phone unless they can pay their own bill, which starts with lawn mowing, babysitting, or other kind of chores or part-time jobs. And maybe that is a great solution because, you know, as I said, there are other devices that can do this beside a phone. But if you're going to go to that level of having a phone, I think that enforcing the importance of that and the ramifications of it for the child by having them be responsible for paying the bills is a pretty good idea.
Okay, so. Yeah, you go ahead and hire this 11-year-old kid to babysit for your kid.
Well, there are other ways. How about pet sit?
Oh, I don't know. Depends on what kind of animal, I guess. I don't know.
We're not going to go there. Yeah. All right. We were talking about brain hacking earlier. Let's get back into what we can tell about our brains and the relationship that might have toward legal proceedings, because we've learned that brain scans can lead to lighter sentences because we can, I guess, hack at what's going on inside that person's brain and figure out exactly, you know, how punitive a sentence could be or should be. Josh, you were pretty interested in this development. Why don't you bring us up to speed here?
Yeah, so I saw this on the New York Times, I think last week, and I thought it was a really interesting issue. So these researchers had created a semi-fictional case of this man they called Jonathan Donahue, and it was apparently based on a real case. And the fact pattern is that Donahue beats the manager of a Burger King so badly that he falls into a coma or he's brain damaged or something like that. So the police basically ask him why he did that and why he beat him for so long. And his response is, well, he wouldn't stop crying, so I kept beating him. So, you know, terrible facts. He's arrested. He goes to jail. He brags about his crime to the other inmates and even gets a tattoo of a crown signifying the Burger King franchise, sort of poking fun at what he'd done. Sentencing comes around and he just shows absolutely no remorse at all during his allocution. So this is the fact pattern that they made. There is a transcript that came from it that they generated, and 181 judges from across the country volunteered to review the case and sort of issue a sentencing order. So all of the judges read testimony from a psychiatrist who explained that Donahue was diagnosed as a psychopath. So literally all 181 judges saw that. However, there was one group of judges that got additional testimony from a neurobiologist. And the neurobiologist said two things. One, that Donahue possessed a specific genetic variant that had been linked to violent behavior. So he was genetically predisposed to just being a violent person. Then he also testified that there had been research done on other psychopaths that had revealed that their type of brain abnormalities could sort of undermine the normal person's aversion to harming others. So these people are just more likely to harm other people and not really care about it. So the group of judges that hears only the testimony of the psychiatrist end up giving Donahue a 14-year sentence on the average. And then the judges who heard testimony from the psychiatrist and the neurobiologist end up sentencing for 13 years on the average. Now, it doesn't sound like a big difference. Oh, I forgot to mention, the people who heard testimony from the neurobiologists when they were sort of rationalizing their sentence, they cited too many more mitigating factors, including mental illness and that sort of thing. So it doesn't sound like a big difference, but, you know, two things. First is that it is statistically significant. And the second would be that a year in federal prison, you know, is a long time. So biomechanics really is a field that's been around since the 70s. And it's interesting that we're at a point now that humans have sort of adapted how they think about culpability in light of genetic predispositions. So I sort of just really wanted to throw the question out there, you know, do we think it's fair that there could be these two people, right? Two people who are literally exactly alike in basically every single way. They do the same crime. They do it in the same manner. They react the same way, get the same attorney. And then one of them has this genetic predisposition to potentially being a violent person. So do we think that it's fair that those two people will get two different sentences? I don't know that I do, but I'm just curious what other people think.
Yeah, that's a toughie. Certainly, I would want to have the most information possible, as long as it's reliable information, you know, for the judicial system to be able to determine what the appropriate sentence is. And I think that, you know, we get into a Daubert kind of issue of what's the reliable science here and how do you demonstrate its reliability before you can go ahead and use that in such an important way. What do you think, Evan?
Well, I agree with you. You need reliable information, but I would not agree that you need all the reliable information that's out there in the world. What you need is reliable information, and you need relevant information. And on the question of how long or how extensively or how severely someone should be punished, I don't think that their brain composition should matter at all. It should only go to the question that it needs to be answered much earlier in the proceedings, that very binary yes or no question: did this person's mens rea match up with what the crime is? Like, if it was murder, did he intend to commit that homicide? So that's where it could be, it should be relevant. You know, and with that, we go with the very same framework that we've had for as long as the law of insanity, you know, when it comes to criminal culpability has been around. If a person's brain is made up in such a way that they can't comprehend, or whatever the standard is, I don't, you know, practice, you know, I don't defend murderers. You know, if their brain structure and chemistry and genetic predisposition is such that they can't formulate the proper mental state, or the mental state that one, the prosecutor needs to show to prove that element of the crime, that's relevant. That's important there. I am scared to death of judges using this as relevant in the sentencing phase, because that seems to be like a slippery slope that could just make us maybe perhaps an analogous way to how our expectations of privacy are eroding. We're eroding them ourselves. You know, is that the same thing that's happening to judges here, where they're just going to be so soft on crime that, oh, this poor kid was born with a brain defect. It has no, he shouldn't go to jail for shooting that woman when he was trying to rape and rob her. You know, oh, it's all okay. You know, if we look at the whole reasons why we punish people, you know, there are several reasons, and big ones are, retribution. We just want to get back at the SLB for doing what he did. We want to incapacitate him, get him off the streets, so he's not going to do that again. If we start taking in these factors of his brain disposition, those ends, those objectives of criminal law are not served at all. In fact, they're completely defeated, because if we're going to let someone's brain composition, their congenital makeup triumph over the facts of what they did, then those ends of criminal law are going to be, you might as well write those out, strike those out of all kind of principle or policy underlying why we punish criminals in the first place.
I just want to say something there. The Supreme Court, in a number of cases over the last 15 or 20 years, has said that evidence such as this, or similar evidence about a defendant's upbringing, their IQ, whether they're an alcoholic, other things about their life, are exactly the type of evidence that the jury needs to consider in a death penalty case in deciding whether or not a defendant should be sentenced to death. And the failure of counsel to bring these type of evidence to the jury's attention during the sentencing phase could constitute ineffective assistance of counsel. So it's exactly this type of evidence that the Supreme Court has said is relevant and needs to be given to the jury. It's not a question of culpability. It's a question of what is a proper sentence. And the Supreme Court again and again has said that a defendant's IQ, everything like this, needs to be considered by the jury. It's not a question of letting the defendant walk free and saying that he's not culpable. It's putting things into context. And I think it's a very important piece of the sentencing puzzle, and does bring in question whether, in fact, this kind of evidence shown to be reliable, if a defense attorney doesn't, in fact, make this showing to a jury, is that something that could constitute grounds for ineffective assistance of counsel, at least in death penalty cases? So it's a very interesting development in criminal law.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen in this one show how evidence of what's going on in your brain can be important in investigating a crime, and also now here in sentencing. So I think we're going to move more and more in that direction as technology moves forward. One way in which technology is moving forward and perhaps the law is not keeping up is retransmission of broadcast television. We have seen a couple of interesting cases on that this year. The IVTV case is the one where IVTV was found not to be a cable system, and we'll go ahead and make cable system our second MCLE passphrase for the show, episode 177 here today of This Week in Law. And the reason that that's important is it has meaning under the Copyright Act. If you are retransmitting and you are a cable system, there's a compulsory licensing scheme that comes into play, and you can retransmit broadcast television as long as you pay the fees that are involved in that under the law. Here, both the district court and now the Second Circuit Court of Appeals has determined that people who stream broadcast television and retransmit it in that way, and since streaming is by definition either national or also global, that those provisions were not intended to apply to them, that the law was designed to govern more regional outlets who were retransmitting so that people in the rural hinterlands could catch, I guess, their local NBC affiliate. Seems like a kind of an odd decision when you look at it against the backdrop of Aereo, which we talked about several episodes back. This was the thousands of little antenna cases where the retransmission was found to be okay. I have a hard time squaring the two cases, but the Second Circuit, and specifically Judge Chin writing for the Court of Appeals there, really thought that Ivy was out of line here and found that an injunction was in order because of the high likelihood that infringement would be found. And also kind of threw in a gratuitous comment about how the public interest is most served here by enforcing copyright in this instance, because if you don't, then the content creators will have less incentive to actually put their newly created shows out there, because they can just be taken off whatever broadcast transmission method that they're used under the cable television broadcasting system and streamed willy-nilly, and that breaks their whole business model. So he does seem to be really in the camp of protecting the legacy cable broadcast Hollywood entertainment broadcast model. Evan, were you surprised at all about this case?
Well, I don't guess I was surprised, but I think that Judge Chin could have decided differently just as easily and not going through the same analysis that he did. You know, I hear what you're saying. It's like he was kowtowing to the big content industry and all that stuff. And, you know, maybe he was. I'd like to think that as an appellate court judge that he was less influenced by, the vicissitudes of the marketplace or whatever. I think what he may have felt constrained to do was follow what the Copyright Office had said. And I think in turn, the Copyright Office may be more doing the bidding of the lobbyists of big content and all this. So the way I would have liked to have seen Judge Chin avoid having to do that, you know, you hear me again, I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt, saying that it wasn't him that was pandering to big content, but he just was following the law in so doing. You know, he did what's called the Chevron analysis, where, you know, if you're looking at a statute and trying to figure out what something means, if it's not clear from what the language of the statute is and the legislative intent and all that stuff, you go then and look to see if any administrative agency has spoken on this. And so I really think that he could have done the first part of that analysis without having to look at what the Copyright Office had said, by just looking at Section 111 of the Copyright Act that defines what a cable system is. Remember, the whole issue in the case is whether or not IVTV, IVI, whatever we're calling it, was a cable system under the Act, because if it is, then it gets that compulsory license and it's free to distribute this content, stream it over the internet, over the web. And so he got kind of hung up in the statutory language, saying, well, is IV a facility that's located in the United States and that it does all this stuff? And that's, you know, that's the key noun in Section 111 definition of a cable system. That's kind of the threshold thing. It's got to be a facility. And he was like, they went into this evaluation of, well, is the internet a facility? You know, it's not really. You know, there were amendments to the Copyright Act later that say that the satellite particularly is a facility. You know, satellite transmission is particularly a cable system. So we don't really know. So I think that if you look at the way cable systems are, they're not, you know, like Comcast, for example, is not just one building in one place with four walls can constitute a facility. I mean, what it as a cable system is a very diverse network of literal wires going across the geography. So very much in the same way that the internet is. So I would have liked to have seen Judge Chin, put more reliance on what the word facility or less reliance actually on what the word facility worried about it less is what I'd like to have seen him do in this analysis. And then he wouldn't have had to go down that path of looking at what the Copyright Office had said, which seems to, as best as I can tell, to be reflective of very aggressive lobbying efforts on the part of big content over the last 25 years.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think we're stuck with a double standard here that the cable industry, as we think of it, is getting swept under one broad brush of transmission and more innovative technologies are being barred at the door. Professor James Grimmelman has a really good article that Colin here in the studio pointed me toward right before we started today. It's called Why Johnny Can't Stream, How Video Copyright Went Insane. Deploying 10,000 tiny antennas makes no technical sense, but the law demands it. That's over at Ars Technica, and you can find that and all the rest of the links to what we've discussed today at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/177. Quick thoughts from Peter and Josh, and then we'll move on to our resources of the week.
Okay,
just real quickly, I don't necessarily think that decision was wrong by the Second Circuit. I think the real problem is that the law just doesn't keep up with the change in technology. And I think if the decision is objectionable, it's really for Congress to make that decision to amend the law to make sure that streaming video is included and protected under 111 of the Copyright Act.
All right, Josh?
I'm going to respectfully disagree with Evan just a little bit here. I think that the court actually had to reach so that they could reach the second method of statutory interpretation and actually look at that policy. Because when you get to that part, you know, it's a pretty clear-cut win. The Copyright Office doesn't think that 111 should apply. The reason that they enacted the 111 in the first place was to sort of bring TV to rural America. But the court really sort of jumped on this definition of facility, as Evan pointed out. And they said, you know, well, the internet isn't really a facility as we're thinking about it, so we don't really know how to apply it, and so the statute is ambiguous. So now we have to jump to policy. In actuality, Ivy raised the issue that, hey, they have an actual building where all this stuff is sort of aggregated and presumably, you know, switching is done there and that sort of thing. And we sit, you know, we get it from wires and cables and it goes out from wires and cables. So it seemed like that was their argument. And then the court said, well, yeah, they raised this issue, but, you know, they didn't really talk about where it was located or anything like that. So perhaps if they did, the outcome might have been different. I actually agree that if I were a judge in this case, I would have concurred in the outcome. But I think that their focus on facility was a little misplaced.
Okay, well, I asked our panel before the show. I wasn't able to come up with a good tip of the week this week, unfortunately. Instead, I have two resources for you that I think are pretty good ones. But if any of you guys have a practical tip that you want to toss out, speak now or I will move on. Anybody? Tip of the week? Nope, we are fairly tipless, it sounds like, this week. So let me point you instead to a couple of resources or things to pay attention to online that we think you will like. First of all, there is an International Plain Language Day in the works. We love plain language here on This Week in Law, in contracts and in courts. So there is an Indiegogo project that is designed to help fund and support this. International Plain Language Day will be on October 13th. There are events in South Africa, Canada, the U.S., Sweden, New Zealand, and Argentina. And we think that plain language is good. So if you do too, go check out this Indiegogo project and throw your support behind it. Evan, any thoughts on this one?
Oh, I think complicated language is just fine. You know, it's nice to, you know, dabble in things that are esoteric.
That's right. Latin and all encompassed in there, too.
Yeah.
So also over at EFF, our friends there, we've been talking a lot, of course, about the Apple versus Samsung decision and the verdict from the jury. Defend Innovation is a project that EFF has out there in their action item lists. It's a proposal for reforming the patent system. Has some goals that they would like achieved, including making sure that patents are sound and valid and don't have durations that stifle innovation. So if you also are so inclined, go check out defendinnovation.org, where you can weigh in and throw your weight behind the folks at the EFF. Also, I'm really pleased to tell you guys that, you know, we've been in the process of attempting to have the various states give us credit or allow you to give allow us to give you credit for mandatory continuing legal education. California has been our first target there. And we've had the first of our shows approved for MCLE credit. That's episode 166. It was called What the Frand, another patent-oriented show with Joe Mullen and Steve Nipper were our guests. And you'll see if you go over to our 166 page there, we now have a link where you can request MCLE credit. So if you do that, you'll get a little form, and you put in our two MCLE passphrases for that show, your name and your state bar number. And once you've confirmed with your passphrases that you actually listened to the show, then you'll get routed to where you can download a certificate of attendance, and you no longer have to pay anything to the state bar or submit anything to the bar. You just get your credit. And that one is good for 0.75 hours of participatory credit. As we move through the process, we have other applications pending. As soon as we get four of them approved, knock wood, then all of the shows will be approved in California for MCLE credit. So we're very excited about that, and we hope to keep moving forward and continue to give you that option with the shows. So hopefully, you know, everybody keep their fingers crossed. It's a slow process and there's a lot of bureaucracy involved, but we'd love to be able to do that for you. And with that, I think we'll go ahead and wrap this episode of This Week in Law. We've had fun hacking your brains here today and hacking the brains of our great panelists. Peter Torin, wonderful to meet you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I had a lot of fun.
You can go check out Peter at petertorin.com. Anything else you want to plug before we go ahead and sign off?
No, that's enough.
That'll do her then. Peter is oft quoted out there on the interwebs, so you're going to run into him as you follow along with the kinds of stories that we follow here on This Week in Law. We really appreciate your taking the time today and your insights.
Thank you very much.
And Josh Oriyama, it's great to meet you, and thanks for your great work over at LegalGeekery.com.
Thanks for inviting me, Denise. I had a lot of fun.
Good luck with your PhD. We look forward to calling you doctor here on the show one day.
Thanks. It was great to meet the panelists.
It was wonderful to have you. Evan, great to see you, as usual.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed our conversation. Peter, it was very nice to meet you. Josh, it was really fun talking to you. I've followed Legal Geekery on Twitter for quite some time, so it's great to put a face and a voice with the Twitter ID. So great fun today. Glad to be here.
It sure was. All right, folks, well, you can follow along with us on both Google Plus and Facebook, where we attempt to hack our upcoming shows, get your input on what we should talk about, how things went on prior shows, et cetera. So head on over to our pages there. You can go to our show page at twit.tv/twill for the entire archive, as well as on YouTube and in iTunes. Go ahead and rate us on iTunes if that is the way that you consume the show. We love to get your feedback there as well, and it lends a hand to our ability to give you what you want, which is what we are all about here at Twit and at Twill. And we hope to see you next week. We record the show Fridays at 11 Pacific, 1800 UTC live, or you can catch us after the fact at all of those outlets I just mentioned. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at D Howell over there. And if you want to shoot us an email, you can reach Evan. He's evan@twit.tv. I'm Denise at twit.tv. We love hearing from you. Thanks for all your input and your help as we get ready to do This Week in Law. We'll see you soon. Take care.